Jeff, I'm sorry you got the head cold and plugged up, but I am grateful for the opportunity to be with you tonight. I want to talk just a couple minutes. Let me rephrase that, just a few minutes. On what I call the Christian's money dilemma. Something I've been thinking about quite a while. If you're like a lot of Americans that are aware of what's going on in the world, the last 2 years have been extraordinary. In fact, historic in the economic sense. I think it's pretty well the consensus that the difficulties in the economy don't approach the Great Depression, that is, of the 1930s, but it's being called in much of the literature the Great Recession. Fortunes have been lost. 401ks have become 201ks and 101ks. And there's a lot of angst out there. Obviously, a lot of jobs lost, and got me to thinking about the Christian's approach to money and the dilemma that we as Christians have, in a sense. This one. How do I get that off there? Hurry. Okay. Matthew 6:19-20, very familiar passage. Says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. That's kind of the guideline, the philosophy, if you will, the paradigm that I believe the Christian needs to have. It's to recognize that we live in the world in the physical sense. But that our treasures, that is, everything that really counts to us in an eternal sense, has to be laid up in heaven. So the dilemma is, as someone used to say, how do I live here in the world, but have my heart, my mind, and my soul looking toward heaven? 1 Timothy 6:8-10 is another passage just to set the stage tonight. Where Paul says to Timothy, now godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Can't believe there's not the flat screen TV in there. Can't believe the Corvette is not there. But let me read it again. Oh, having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into a temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. I think sometimes Christians have a very double-minded attitude about money. And so I brought a dollar, that's an actual real dollar, and I just asked the question, you know, what is that money? That money is nothing more than a medium of exchange. It provides convenience so that I can pay someone for their services or for their task or for their as wages for their work. I can pay them for some product that I buy from them. So when I go to the store and buy green bananas, or apples, I can pay them in dollars. They can use those dollars then to buy their supplies and to pay their people, and on it goes. But that's all it is. And that dollar is totally neutral. It can be used for good, and of course it could be used for evil. It could be used to buy drugs and to, fund all sorts of criminal activities. But as they say, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Dollars and money don't do harm in themselves. It's people in the use of their dollars. Now, the Bible does clearly tell us in this passage that the love of money is a whole different matter. It is the root of all kinds of evil. When we think of money, we typically think of the U.S. dollar or the equivalent currency. But in other civilizations, it's been different things. It's been turtle eggs and it's been buffalo hides. And I'm sure there were people dealing in buffalo hides where, you know, their neighbors just said, this fellow over here, he is just eating up. He's with buffalo hides. I mean, he loves them. That's all he thinks about is accumulating them. And he's just gotten to the point where he is worshiping buffalo hides. Well, you can do that, obviously, with the U.S. dollar and its equivalent. 1 Timothy 5:8 gives us another little part of the picture, setting the stage with. If anyone does not provide for his own, and this is written to Christians in the church, if he does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, we could preach many, many sermons on this particular issue right here. But the fact is that the Christian who is responsible for himself and or herself and other people has to work in the broad sense to provide for the family. And those of us who will not or are unwilling to do that, Paul says that we have denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. And I think there would be no hope of change unless we change in that particular attitude. And so we learn very simply, because I'm a simple fellow, we learn that it is not about this world, but the next. We are literally passing through, but oh, by the way, while we're here, we've got to eat, we've got to have shelter, we've got to have transportation, and the other things to support our life so that we can do the things that are really important, and that is in serving God, serving our neighbor, and of course, taking care of and nourishing the family and those that are closest to us. Our real treasure should be stored in heaven and not on earth. Money is not a problem, I don't believe, but the love of money, Paul tells us, and the Bible is replete with other warnings, the love of money is a root of multiple problems, such as greed, which can lead to idolatry. There are people who literally worship money. It is their first waking thought in the morning. It is their last waking thought in the evening, the accumulation of it, and the piling it up, and the things that money can buy. One must work, again, to provide for the family, and failure to do so ranks Christians with the unbelievers. I think those are pretty plain teachings of Scripture. When shall we learn? You know, men and women learn in the technical sense. When you go out and you buy an automobile, that automobile was built upon the knowledge and the learning and the experimentation of generations gone before. They don't just say, oh, you want a car? All right, well, we're going to have to invent that car because we've thrown out all of the lessons and all of the books from the past. No, in the technical world, we build, in the scientific world, we build upon the experimentation and the knowledge that has been accrued in the past. But so often in the human sense of lessons learned, we have to continue to make the same mistakes generation after generation. Here are some, at least 1,000 years B.C., the writer says, if riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. There are bad things that occur when your life is built around the accumulation of riches. Matthew 19:23, it's very hard, not impossible, but it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. You know, that's a strong warning to anyone that is concerned about their soul. And in Matthew 14:4-19, the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the desire for other things choke the word out when it is put into the soil. The deceitfulness of riches, that indicates that it is a deceiver, or riches are a deceiver. They will fool us. They will trick us. They will tell us that some things are important in life when in fact they are not. That said, to say this, the Christian's dilemma, and these are just my words, but the dilemma is that our hearts must be on heaven, but our minds and bodies must be busily employed to earn a living, to care for our families, which we must care for them, and to help others as we have opportunity. In our modern world, in particular, we must be diligent, informed, moderate, savvy, that is, wise to the ways of finance, if you will, and righteous in how we earn and spend and accumulate money, so that ideally, money will then be our servant and not be our master. Well, in the last 2 years, there has been a virtual clinic for anyone that is not living in a phone booth. Virtual clinic on the uncertainty of riches, and that is the economic meltdown of 07 and 09. And I've spent some considerable time analyzing that for various reasons. to try to understand it, for one thing. The historians will be talking about it for decades, just as they have about the Great Depression of the 30s. Many books will be written about it. And I think it's clear to say that not since 1930 have more people been more concerned about the return of their principal than in the return on their principal. There are billions and billions, there are trillions of dollars sitting in money markets today earning 0.1% because people are so afraid of losing their principal, they dare not put it into anything that they consider more risky. These are some of my thoughts on the causes of the meltdown. The reason I'm going through them is, again, simply to illustrate the point that you may think your future is secure, but there are so many things beyond your control that your financial future can be very tenuous and very threatened. Here are a few things that helped to cause this financial crisis. First of all, there were some very good intentions. There were many people in Washington and elsewhere who really did have good intentions. Things like spreading the wealth, making homes available to those who otherwise could not afford them. Lots of things like that. There were some very bad laws that in retrospect you look and you say, what were they thinking? There was some social engineering, again connected with things such as the Community Reinvestment Act, which tried to force banks really into giving loans to lower income people who really could not afford those loans. There's some very lax regulation and oversights by the Securities Exchange Commission, by the banking regulators and others. They just dropped the ball on it big time. There is some stupidity to go around. I just have to, you know, swallow hard and tell you. There's some excess greed. Greed fuels the capitalist society. There are always people who are willing to invest their money in the hopes of making more. But there's a good greed. There is a benevolent greed, if you will, that puts people to work and deals with them honestly and pays them honest wages and doesn't defraud them. That's, you might say, good greed that fuels the capitalist system. But there was a lot of excess greed that helped bring this thing down. There were some subprime loans. Again, I have seen people take out loans for $250,000, $300,000, where if it were told the housing costs would have equaled 50 to 60% of their gross income. It will not work. We've learned those lessons over the last 150 years. And until about 20 years ago, the banks were required to carefully check one's credit, their income, their assets, etc. All that went out the window. Many of these loans were given to people that did not even have to bring in a piece of paper documenting what their income were. It was just on their word. The banker would say, well, you know, you need an income of $55,000 to afford this house. And the guy would say, yeah, we got it, sure. And boom, they take the loan right there, and then of course immediately sell that loan to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other institutions. There's definitely some collusion because there's some many billions of dollars made in the last 10 or 12 years as this stew was percolating. Some very bad banking that threw out again hundreds of years of experience on such things as documenting credit and verifying the good credit of people taking loans. Very lax rating agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's, who were supposed to have done these ratings and gotten the word out to the public, and they were let down. Definitely some fraud. Many people are going to jail for it. Consumer ignorance. People investing in things that they have no clue what they are. And the so-called derivatives, which are so complicated, I make my living in this area, I can barely explain them to you, and people were investing in them like crazy. Some panic. People who had money, for example, in the stock market, once it started growing down, they began to sell out of panic and typically sold at a low and lost billions of dollars cumulative. And this last one, which is difficult to read, is some Democrats, some Republicans, and some bureaucrats. Folks, there is lots of blame to go around, and I'm not just pointing one finger. But it was a witch's stew, so to speak, that almost brought down the economic system of the United States. A recipe for an historic economic and financial crisis. That's what it was. Well, the aftermath, and this is how people are feeling, I can promise you. Like as two authors here wrote, he says, like the feelings of betrayal following the discovery of a partner's affair, clients are experiencing a range of feelings, shock, anger, resentment, despair, and shame. Some just say, how could I be so stupid? Well, you were led down it by a massive system that brought it down. At its most fundamental level, basic trust in this relationship, that is, with investment advisors or financial institutions, has been broken. And I can attest to you that that is the feeling of many investors across the country right now. It will take years, if not decades, to recover that trust and reach some sort of normality going forward. Man, that's scary. That is scary. Me and my ducky there with the cat. That is a scary situation that the system could nearly be brought down the way it was with that recipe for financial crisis. The post-crash consumer, more job insecurity. This is the same mentality you saw in the Depression. Those who lost their jobs, they just had to go back, move in with mom or dad or whatever. But those who had jobs demonstrated almost paranoia in terms of insecurity, that the axe could fall at any moment on them and they would be out of their job. More boomers are working longer. The baby boomers now in their 40s and 50s and even early 60s. Many of them said, oh, I'm not working past 60. Well, they're finding they're having to. The little dog here reminds me of the story about the guy was talking to another guy about his dog, and he says, well, what does your dog eat? And the guy says, well, I feed him turnip greens. And the second guy said, well, my dog will not eat turnip greens. And the first guy said, well, mine wouldn't either for the first 3 months. You get hungry enough, and your dog will eat turnip greens. And you get hungry enough, and a boomer will go back to work to put food on the table and pay the utilities. For unretirees, people who, again, thought they would retire, are going back to the job. More fear about living longer, more fear of running out of money, tougher to afford college. Some I've known parents that just said, look, good luck with college. I don't have enough to help you. And if you can work or get a loan or whatever, more power to you. And more multi-generational homes. I love my daughters. I don't want them moving back in with me. It's happening all over this country. Two, in some cases, three generations now living in the home, in the same home to try to save money. And then eventually, and this is my hope, but this eventually could lead to a better society. I mean, we can shake out the foolishness and have a more grounded, more serious, more savers, and we are definitely seeing that now. America has gone from being a debtor nation to actually saving a little bit now. Less consumerism, less just, I've got some money, it's burning a hole in my pocket, I want to go out and spend it. I'm starting to see this with young people. 5 years ago, many young people got out of college. First thing they did is they want to go out and, buy the big car. It's not happening so much now. Now they're saying, I'm getting out of college. I'm getting a job. Hey, I'm going to take it easy. I'm going to drive the old car for another 100,000 miles or whatever. And that in the long run, I think is good. And that's why I'm relatively positive about this direction we're going. More people who need people. People are realizing that they have to depend on others now. And they're saying, whom can I trust and whom can help me? Now, I don't want this to be a lesson on economics. I want to make the spiritual lessons. Is that this group right now here, we got to pull together. We've got to help each other because we can trust each other, by and large. And we can help each other. It is difficult to go beyond a group like this where we know each other personally and know who we can trust and who, in fact, can help us. Less irrational exuberance. That was a phrase from Alan Greenspan when the markets were going up, 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 and up, and the feeling was they'll never go down again. Well, they did. And then perhaps even a new greatest generation, the Depression decade. It formed people's character, and that never left them. Those people who came of age in the 30s, like my mom and dad. My dad was 17 years old in 1929 when the stock market crashed. That was a scary period. I always wondered why my dad didn't finish high school. He only went through the 11th grade. Now I know. He had to go back on the farm and help his dad eke out a living in 1930 and 31 and 32. Same with my mom. She's born in 1918, finished the 11th grade, got married early. But that Depression decade, it formed them forever. They became, you know, savers. They became suspicious, really, of investments they didn't understand, even banks. That character that they developed never left them. I used to wonder, maybe some of you that are my age, I'm only 30, but I can remember I'd go and eat with my uncle, and he was a big imposing guy with a gruff voice, and he'd say, "Boy," he said, "you put something on that table, you're gonna eat it. You put them greens on there, you're eating every bite." And I was scared to death. Well, now I know why. Because he was formed in the 30s where you never threw anything away. Perhaps we will even form a new greatest generation. And this is my hope, that just as in the 30s, the churches of Christ, the movement which we know as the churches of Christ, had tremendous growth in the 30s and early 40s. Because when things are not so good on this world, people think, well, you know, I'm just a pilgrim. I'm looking up. And hopefully we will see that, and I think we will. Understand this. No one knows what the future holds. I certainly don't. And that's why we call it the future. It's out there. We don't know. But however, the past is very instructive to those who are willing to learn from it. And here's a freebie. I charge nothing for this. It is what you learn after you know it all that counts. You know, if you're sitting here and you say, "I know it all," well, good luck. It's what you learn from this point forward that will really make the difference for you in your life. Got that? Well, now what do I do? Well, you've got to decide what you believe. You cannot die of 1,000 ant bites. You have to come to grips with all of this and say, "Here's what I believe. I'm putting my faith in God, and I believe that He will take care of not only this world, but certainly me. He knows the hairs on my head. He will not desert me." If you believe that the U.S. economy is terminal, however, if that is your faith, and if you've come to grips with that and you said, you know, it's going down the tube, or as the old guy from Maine used to say, going down the turlet. I mean, I had to listen several times to figure out what he was saying. But he, you know what I meant. If you believe the U.S. economy is going down the turlet, then you need to learn how to garden. I'm telling you, Jim Crawford, I'm hoping he's giving lessons in the whole Crawford family. And, you know, carrots are cool. Learn how to grow carrots, because you're going to need it. Learn the protocol of bartering. I am told that bartering is best when it's done on Monday, because you don't ever want to lose that first customer. So, you know, I'll give you my pair of shoes, you know, for that hat and gloves. We're going to have to learn to do that. You're going to need to buy a used sewing machine and then learn how to use it. And because you're going to be making your own clothes, right, when it really gets bad. And get one with a foot pedal, because the electricity is going to be turned off. We're not going to be able to afford the power plants. It's all going out. Practice your cold weather survival skills. You need to know how to survive up here in the winter, because there's going to be no power and the economy is going to tank. And you're going to have to learn to survive on your own. It's very, very good to keep the feet dry. You got to work on the feet, keep them dry, and avoid the frozen feet. And I think you need to move to the mountains, or at least over to Lancaster County, because you need to get away from the hordes in the city who cannot survive, and they're going to be coming and wanting to steal the little food that you've basically got left. So if that's the way you think it's going, those are just some practical things to do. Now, if you're working for a living and you think that the economy will continue, or at least you hope it will, I have a really good question for you and for myself. Would you hire you if you were evaluating yourself and looking at your experience and knowing how you work with people? Would you hire yourself? And if not, why not? are you part of the problem or of the solution? I promise you, if you're working for a boss, and most of us are, that boss has got loads of problems. When he or she comes into work every day, their day is filled with problems. You're either a problem for him or her, or you're part of the solution, someone that they can depend upon to help them. Are you crew or cargo? I want to tell you, in good times, ships just go out, they sail in the ocean, you know, and it's just fine. The crew makes it and the cargo makes it, no problem. But in the storms, when the storms come and the ship is in danger of sinking, who do they throw away? They don't throw off the crew, they throw off the cargo. And if you're just marking time at your job and bringing nothing to that job and in fact causing problems for that boss, I'm telling you, in the difficult times, you will be the easy one to let go. On the other hand, if you're in the cargo, you're on the team, you're giving it all, not just the 8 hours a day and going home, but you're putting in the extra time and you're making the suggestions to improve that organization, then you're part of the cargo and you're going to probably stay on there when the storms get rough. In Proverbs 24, verses 30 and 31, the writer says, I went by the field of the lazy man and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles and its stone wall was broken down. The lazy man or woman, it's going to tell at some point. It will catch up with you. One of the best great things that parents can teach their children is to work, to do tasks, and to complete what they start. You don't let them, you know, start something and then just put it down and forget it. You know, emphasize that they need to continue and finish what they start. Give an honest day's labor for a day's wages, and anything else hurts you. Anything less hurts you and steals from your employer. Your employer is paying you for the 8 or 9 hours a day or whatever it is and expects an honest day's work. If you're dawdling and playing and, you know, and doodling, you're literally stealing the money from your employer. A lot of people grapple with this. What are you worth? And I don't mean in the spiritual sense, because I can't place a value on anyone's soul. It is literally unlimited. But in the physical sense, we have to place a value on somebody. That's why brain surgeons are paid as much in a day sometimes than, say, you know, a janitor would be paid in a year. It's not because they are inherently one is more valuable than the other, but a person's reward in terms of those dollars I talked about, I think is determined by this formula. It's the demand for what you do, like brain surgery, you know, people willing to get it and pay almost anything for it when you need brain surgery, plus your ability. They're not going to pay me to do brain surgery. I don't have that ability. I mean, it would be a real last-ditch effort, you know, but if I was one of the best ones in this area, then I couldn't help to meet that demand. And then finally, difficulty to replace. Takes years and years to be a brain surgeon. You have to be smart. You have to look and know how to read and do books. I mean, you've got to be very capable to do that. So when the demand is high and your ability is good and you are difficult to replace, then you're going to get top dollar, so to speak, in the job. Now, notice that you can affect all three of those things to a degree. You can increase your ability and your worth in that marketplace or in that workplace. You can be a better employee. You can be cheerful and helpful and making suggestions and realizing that boss has got a lot of problems on his or her plate too. And by being the good employee who's part of the solution every day and not part of the problem, you become very difficult to replace because if we let you go, it literally will bring down the entire operation and the business. Most of us have the power to affect all three of these factors, and this is a great realization, through hard work, improved ability, a great attitude, and a cooperative spirit in the workplace. Make ourselves the type of people that boss wants to have around, and we'll make it through the difficult times. Now, good credit is critical, and we have largely lost that knowledge. Easy credit is largely to blame for the entire economic problems that we are facing. It's a complicated issue, but the giving of those subprime and even less than subprime mortgages, and those things were packaged and then sold all over the world and leveraged up to 60 or 70 times. That means for $1,000 you could buy $70,000 of that bad credit. And the presumption was, oh, you'll never have that many defaults in the housing industry that would cause any problems with that. Well, famous last words, because when people started defaulting on those mortgages, it rippled through the entire world and helped to bring down the giants like Lehman Brothers and Smith Barney and all of the others. Easy credit is largely blamed. Now, failure on a personal level, failure to pay voluntary debts is stealing. And all you have to do to understand that is think of the golden rule. If I borrowed money from you and then just said, you know, I'm not going to pay it back, how would you feel? You would justifiably be angry. Now, if it's a gift, that's something else. But if it's a bona fide loan to me and I just walk out and don't pay it, you are justified in not liking that. And the same is true even if it's on the credit cards, it's with the auto dealer, it's with the bank or whomever. That money is coming out of someone's pocket. Society may yawn at it, but the Christian cannot. And that's what I'm trying to bring home tonight. Live within or below your means and do not buy what you have no hope of paying for. Example, like of using your credit card for treats and just, you know, good times out. Those are perishable items. If you can pay for them, fine. If you can't, those have to go away. Excessive debt is a robber. It is a robber. It will rob you of your money because the interest can get just amazingly high. I've seen clients with 25, 28% credit card interest. They will have no hope, probably, of ever paying that money back. It'll rob you of peace of mind. It'll rob you of the peaceful relations with the others that you owe. You'll find yourself avoiding those relatives or that banker whom you owe the money to and cannot pay it. It will rob you of your good name and reputation. It'll make it at some point very difficult for anyone to trust you. And it can rob you of your health because if you'll be worried so much about it, you may not eat well, you may not sleep well. It can literally shorten your physical life. Now, there are a lot of things in the world, to wrap it up here, that you and I cannot control. And my advice is, you know, have a good cry about it, get over it, and then go on with your life. There's just some things you cannot control. Most actions of other people. Now, until that child is 10, 12 years old, you can pretty much force your will on them. You can make them stand in the corner, go to bed, make their bed, you can get it. But I'm telling you, around 14, 15, there's a metamorphosis that occurs. You can beat them to death. You know, this is old, like the old expression, you can beat a dead horse, but you cannot make him drink. And at some point, that child is really, the character is formed, you'll not be able to influence them very much. Much less other people that are not your family members. You can't much control the actions of other people, including your boss or your coworker. Acts of nature like weather and storms, get over it. You're not going to affect much of that. Many health issues. Now, there are some you can influence, and there you can hurt your health by habits and activities and things of that nature. Most government actions you won't have much impact on. You can write your congressman, I hope you do on times, but you're not going to have a lot of influence. Inflation, largely beyond your control. The strength of the nation's economy and societal threats like crime and various abuses, we can rail about it, but, you know, we can't do much about it, except for those that are immediately around us. But here's some things you can control. And these, to me, were great realizations. I was kind of in my 20s and 30s when I began to read and think about some of these things. The thing that I can control is my attitude every day. Now, I don't always do a good job with it. And those closest to me would be the first to tell you that. But I do work on it. I try to tell myself in the morning that my day will not be dependent upon the actions of those around me, that I have the power to control my attitude, my thoughts, how I approach other people. I can control, and you can control, your activities, largely where you go and particularly whom you associate with. Your companions, yes, you can control them, because the Bible says, you know, to take heed of our, you know, good evil companionship will corrupt good morals. So it is within our choice to choose the companions we have. Our habits, hopefully they don't become a habit, but the activities that lead up to making them a habit are clearly within our choice. And your treatment of other people, I'm not the paragon of virtue, but I try to give people the benefit of the doubt until I learn differently. I try to treat people as if they're honest, as if they're good, as if they're caring and concerned. Now, some of them will slap you right back in the face, and you'll learn that fine enough. But I want to start out, as the Bible says, as much as what lies within me, to live at peace with all men. And the way I do that is to try to go out and at least assume that people are good and decent and honest and treat them with respect until perhaps I cannot respect them anymore. Your work ethics, how you approach your work, is totally within your purvey of choice. And then finally, your response to God, and that should have gone first, but I wanted to put it on the bottom. Because your response to God and His Son from this point on is He is the one who will help us with all of the above as we improve ourselves and perfect our approach and our attitude and our actions with those around us. In closing, I think very perilous times are here. I mean, they're always here, but I'm telling you, the last 2 years have shook a lot of us. I worked for 15 years in the financial services market. And to sit there at my desk and see, you know, Lehman Brothers just tank in 2 weeks, and their stock went from like $60 to worthless, you say, how does that happen? I mean, it gets your attention, no question. And I've spent a couple of years now trying to understand how that happened. It's a time of great peril. Financially, it's perilous. Morally, I mean, our country has so many, you know, moral issues, just things that I never would have thought I would see in my youth. Enemy threats to our nation. We've got people, folks, that want to kill us because you're an American, and doubly want to kill you because you're a Christian. And if you're American and Christian, they'll kill you and then shoot you again and then slit your throat. There are people that really, really, really hate us in America, and particularly because we are Christians. And it's not because of things we do and things we say to them. It is because of who we are. And that is very difficult to change unless you denounce your American citizenship and give up your faith in Christ. You're in the group that they want to kill. So we're going to be dealing with that for decades. It's a long war. It won't go away quickly. There is apathy in the churches. People just seem to be in a blue haze. They just and I think it's shock. I think it's dealing with the fallout of all the problems that we have seen in society, and we're dealing with broken families. And the human wreckage is just phenomenal. And the abused children, and the neglected children, and the deserted children, and the killings that are occurring in the families. I mean, that's very disheartening. And there are deep, deep, deep political divisions over fundamental social issues. Abortion and marriage and on, and the country is just gravely divided, and that's not going to go away very soon. So, if you find that life is not going the way you want it, then insanity could be defined as continuing to do the same thing and expecting a different outcome. That's probably a good definition for insanity. I don't like what's going on. I don't like what's happening. I don't like my habits. I don't like the way I'm working. I don't like things, the way people are treating me. And I don't like the way people are treating me and I'm treating them. Well, if you don't like it, if you don't change, and if nothing ever changes, then nothing ever changes. That's profound. If it doesn't change, it won't change. And if not you, it is up to you and to me And if not now, then when? You know, it can't just be tomorrow, next week, next month, I'll get around to it. If we need to make changes in our lives, in the workplace, in our families, and particularly in our response to God, it's got to be now. Because literally tomorrow will never come. It will continue to just be tomorrow, and we'll continue to kick it down the road. It is time to get in the boat. I think it's always been time to get in the boat, but these are particularly perilous times. It is time to get in the boat to make it through the storms. Matthew 16:26, for what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world? Can you imagine? All of the cars, all of the gold, all of the toys, all of the airplanes owned by one person. And if he loses his own soul, or what would a man give in exchange for his soul? The good news is that God did not call His people for a lifetime of worry. Philippians 4:6-7, be anxious for nothing. Whoa, we got problems. Yeah, we got them. Lots of them, and lots more I hadn't even, in the interest of time, hadn't gotten to. There are lots of reasons to worry, but the Bible says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God will guard your hearts and mind through Jesus Christ Jesus. The ideal is for the Christian to be able to pillow his head or her head every night and to sleep with the assurance that whatever occurs, it will be all right. You know, it is well with my soul. If I die tonight, it's well. I just go over to the other side and I'm with Christ and the angels and all of the redeemed. If I live, I'll have some difficulties, but with God's help, I will make them. And meanwhile, I will be doing everything within my power to be the kind of worker, the kind of mother, the kind of father, the sister, the brother, and the child to my parents that I possibly can be, and realizing that God has promised me His help and assistance all the way. Jesus' invitation is the best and cannot be improved on. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe it. Wait a minute, we got bad times. Oh, yes. Oh, wait a minute, we got people who want to bring down the country. Oh, yeah. Oh, we got terrible political activity. Oh, absolutely. Hey, we've got the other party or whatever it may be. Yeah, but let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. Now, that's the condition. Is we believe in God and, of course, obey Him. Then you also believe in Christ. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. That's the promise. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Hope it's been helpful. Went over a little bit of time, but if you need to make a response or just, you know, ask for the prayers of the congregation, we just need to pull together. We just need to think of ourselves not just as a group of, folks coming from all different parts, but a team of Christians coming together to help each one of us perfect ourselves to the best of our ability, to literally, as the Army slogan was, to be all we can be as a Christian. We're all starting from different points, got different challenges, different abilities and whatever, but we can all help one another in getting there. Let's stand and sing.